Thanks for coming on. Thanks for doing the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've just spent time in Turkey. Can you tell us what you've been doing there? Because I was quite surprised. I saw a news story with the president and the work that you've been doing with the Syrian refugees.
I've been going there for the past 4 months. I stayed there and I hurt my finger on my friend's boat, so it kind of kept me there. So I got to the hospital and I had a really good doctor and they put my finger back together and the nail's growing back and I have all nerve endings. And I stayed there. And that moment when that happened with my finger, I realized, I was like, there's a reason that I'm still here. And this is not just BS. This really happened. And I had this feeling and I said, there's something, you know, everything's going on in this world. All these things are happening in Syria. There's a lot of, and I love working with children. I did it in India. I've done it, you know, I've been working with kids since I was a kid. So I said, I want to meet people that can take me to go to Antep and go to the refugee camps, the container camps. And so I ended up staying. If that didn't happen to my finger, I was flying that morning. Like, I was going to fly after that. So I stayed. And I went to Antep and I met with Fatima, the mayor of Antep, and I went to these container camps. When I got back to Istanbul from Antep, I met with this family. And I walked into where they were living, and I don't even know words can express it. They were living in a room, basically. I mean, they had no heating, they had no lighting. There was nothing there, literally nothing there.
Yeah.
The father had his legs blown off in Syria. The mother had left the family. And I've been seeing this family over and over and going to check on them. And I don't go with cameras and acknowledgement. I go because the little girl, now her father has a phone and she sends me messages and she's learning English. And that's the first language they learn in school there. So it's a part of me now. I can't personally speak on something I haven't lived through in my own way, that I haven't walked through, seen, checked out, looked at, felt. You need to actually live through an experience to discuss it. And, you know, I'm gonna say something I don't want to say, but we have a president now that basically has never lived through any of these things that he's changing.
Yeah.
That's really scary.
For us as British people, you know, Donald Trump comes in and we all thought, to be honest, it would never happen. And I have a very pragmatic view because you look at it and go, okay, it's a democratic country, they elected him. You can't say everyone's an idiot, but every time something comes out of his mouth, you think, is this a joke?
You know, it was really funny the other day when I was sitting with President Erdogan. I get to say that now, which sounds really cool. but he said something that really hit me. He has spent over, $25 billion in letting people into his country and helping them, refugees. Whereas President Donald Trump is building a wall that will cost $25 billion to keep people out.
Yeah.
That says a lot.
But for you as well, you have been, you know, you've had a history of being lambasted by the tabloids for various things. But one of the things that struck me is there was an occasion where you wore a headscarf. Mm. And then another occasion where you were seen carrying a copy of the Quran. And you ended up suffering abuse for that, which just seems to... I don't know whether we're more tolerant in England or what, but to me, that just seems such a fickle thing for people to attack you for.
Well, I'm a very spiritual person, and I believe in all religions. And I'm, you know, I was raised Catholic, and my mother always kept me... My sister's Buddhist, but I'm always interested in learning different cultures, and I think that's the main point of it. And when I was in America, I felt very subjected, always, you know, because I had certain things that I put myself in bad situations of. But I had certain moments where anything that I found of solace to me, people wanted to objectify it and make it look like a bad thing.
Yeah.
And that was really scary for me. Like, do you think I feel safe going to the USA right now? I don't think so.
Well, as you say, to be honest, when we book any guest, you look at research, and you if I don't know the person like I didn't know you personally, you have a preconceived idea of them. I couldn't believe some of the vitriol that has been directed at you throughout your life, but particularly over things like that. Like that recent thing with the headscarf.
Well, it kind of started with my father. I mean, he was partners with Jordan Belfort.
explain that to people who don't know the English.
No, I just grew up and, you know, my father was working on Wall Street. And he went through that whole Wolf of Wall Street phase with him. So I was subjected to a lot of things at a very early age in life. And people kind of harped on that. And my father lost touch with being with his daughter. And I think that kind of upset him. And he just wanted to get in touch with me. And I didn't want to deal with him because he was too erratic. And my mom tried to stay strong for all of us. And I said, I'm going to take care of everybody. I'm going to make sure everyone's okay. So I just worked because it was therapy for me being on set. So now I'm in a place, I said, when I turn 30 years old, I'm going to have my own company. I'm going to have my own studio. I'm going to have all my own things that I don't have to answer to anyone.
You've said a number of times that you have an empathy for children in extreme circumstances. It's although some people would say it's completely different, it seems also completely the same. Like you were in a model agency at the age of 3, and then you first started coming on television appearances about 6 or 7. But your first breakthrough film role that was massive was Parent Trap. What was great about it for you at that tender age? I mean, you were playing with Dennis Quaid and your accent.
I was kind of living my life story at that time.
In what respect? You've got
my
a twin?
My parents were separated, so it was like I was always trying to fix everything as a kid.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to just let it go and let it live itself and let it fix itself.
So for you, when you're looking at that time in your life, because all of a sudden you were 12, you've been in a Hollywood film, but then you went home, you went back to normal life. And you mentioned this sort of relationship with your dad being a little bit disruptive, to say the least. Were you working to get away from it?
No, I'm very close with my dad, actually. He's a very strong character. Like, he raised me to always take care of everyone else, always take care of myself, and make sure everyone's always okay.
Yeah.
He always said, never let anyone pay for you. So when I went on my first date, and I paid for the check, it was really awkward. emasculating to the person I was with.
Oh, yeah, but there's someone
I was like, my father told me, no one should ever pay for me.
There's some guy somewhere probably pumping gas now going, once.
Yeah, it's called my ex-fiance.
Yeah, but all of a sudden, you've become a star, you've become recognised, and as you said, a real breadwinner, because you were, by the time you were 18, you were getting $7 million a film. That's not candy floss money. Yeah. According to my research and to the IRS.
I play the fifth. for me, working, doing movies, I've never done anything because it's about the money.
Yeah.
I just like doing it. I'll never do anything because it's about signing that check or anything. Everything that I do, there's a meaning behind all of it. It's doing a movie because then it takes someone out of their own moment for that situation where you can sit in a room and forget about all the things you have to deal with. And you can relate and know that there's someone out there, whether it's the character on the screen or that person playing that character, that gets it. Mm. So that's why I like to make movies. The philanthropic side of things I do is because that feeds my soul.
Yeah.
I mean, seeing these, actually look at, you're like, oh wait, I actually have a bed to sleep in tonight. Whereas these kids are sleeping on the floor, they don't know what a bed is.
But the child that you were then, obviously,
Yeah, but we had to move houses a bunch of times to hide from things in my life and my dad, and he was there and then he wasn't there and he was great and then he was scary. And I'm not painting my dad a bad picture. I love my father. He's a good man. He's changed. His life is very different now. He only works in helping other people. But I felt a responsibility at a very young age to make sure that my mom and my siblings didn't have to witness what I witnessed when my parents would fight.
So how do you mean what you witnessed?
Just they would have bad fights, and I never wanted my siblings to be exposed to that. So I can't imagine what it feels like for a kid with a bomb going off next door.
Yeah.
That's worse than a fight. So I'm just very protective of children. I've always felt this need to just, if I have time and I feel like I'm not doing anything, then I might as well go do something and help other people.
But you had this vehicle, I suppose, that gave you a degree of status, because within the family, you were contributing to the family, so you could...
Well, my grandfather, my mom's dad, started St. Vincent de Paul, and he was in World War II, and he was a doctor.
Yeah.
And when I got home from doing the Parent Trap, my father took me to Make-A-Wish, and I started working with kids from Make-A-Wish. He goes, you may have done this movie, but now you're going to work with kids, so you can see what people have and don't have. And so my dad gave me that light, and so did my grandfather, my mom's father and my dad. And that was really important. I think it was important that they kind of instilled that in me, because it kept me humble my whole life. You know, there's nothing like going back home and seeing your family and then recognizing. It's very easy in this world that we live in to have all of this really quick and then none of this really fast. Mm. So there has to be a middle ground somewhere. But that's not going to come from anywhere, not from a mother, not from a father, not from family, but from here. So you have to actually experience ups and downs in order to kind of level yourself, I think.
Now you're talking as a 30-year-old woman whose life, as we will no doubt go through, has been amazing. Like, you feel, when I say amazing, it has had massive highs and it's had massive lows. But when you were in the middle of it, when you were in those teenage years, and what you're saying about your dad, seems like he's both wonderful and terrible. He's
like Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, he's the best thing in your life and the worst thing in your life. For any teenage child to manage that kind of parental relationship is difficult. When you look back at that, is there a point where you wish you could have stopped it? Yeah, I mean, when I say stop it, not stop the tension with your mum and dad, but stop the other thing, the work side of things.
I don't think it was... I think it was out of my hands at that point.
Yeah.
It was a whirlwind, you know? I think when you're in it, especially living in, like, L.A. and California with these people around that you barely even know all the time, and you think you're your friends. There was moments when I called my mom, and my mom said, you need to come home.
Yeah.
But my head was in work mode, so I just kept going. I just kept, like, stepping on, like, lead to foot, you know? I was, like, kept going. And that was all I really knew at that moment. And then it hit me, and I was like, I want to come home.
But you left home at 18 and went to California?
No, I left at, like, turning 17.
Yeah.
When I started doing Mean Girls, I was 17 in Toronto. And from Toronto, it was Freaky Friday, Mean Girls, and then I went back to L.A. I should have gone back to New York.
Yeah, yeah.
I should have listened to my mother.
But I mean, also, for people who perhaps not as familiar with your film career, I mean, it's massive. You've done 21 films. I was looking at this. 21 films. You've acted with 18 people who've, within their career, have been nominated for Academy Awards, for Oscars. You know, those 18 people between them have had either won or at least been nominated 57 times. So, like, your career is a career, and, you know, your films have grossed over $500 million.
You think I don't get a little angry when the Hollywood Foreign Press doesn't nominate me?
No, that's what I mean. And sometimes when you look at it, the press portrayal of you would almost be like you're a reality star. You think, actually,
yeah,
this
weird.
Is a talented actress who has played with the best actors of our generation.
Thank you.
I didn't watch Mean Girls when it come out. I mean, when Mean Girls come out, I probably was married with 3 kids, and it's not...
It would be weird if you were watching that.
Yeah. I'm just going to start. I watched the films with similar titles, but they were different.
Okay, I don't want to know about that. That's a whole different show.
You know what? I actually really, really liked it, of that kind of rom-com teenage film. It's really funny. I mean, that's still, it's like a cult film now. It still gets seen, still gets played. It's a great film. At that time, though, that was the pivotal point where you became, I guess, prey for the paparazzi.
Yeah. Also, I was alone in L.A., so I think that people start to see that. And paparazzi in L.A., you know, they're people that are hired to drive into your car just to get that first reaction. Like, they're hired to do that specifically.
But that's
so I was like, maybe I just shouldn't. Everyone's like, just don't drive, Lindsay, hire a driver. I was like, that's expensive to hire a driver every
day.
You're
not $7 million a film.
Do you think you get all that?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, but it's. I was like, that's expensive. I don't want to have a driver. I just, when I'm not working, I want to be able to, you know, drive to the beach.
Normal,
and.
Yeah.
But what I recognized was, it's people, places, and things. So you put yourself in a situation where you know you're going to be photographed or watched after that. So it's just avoiding those situations.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's true. I mean, you are what you put yourself in. So I didn't want to hear that then. It took me till afterwards to figure that out.
But was anyone telling you that?
Yeah, of course. My mother was telling me that every day.
Do you think your life would have been dramatically different if you'd have gone back to New York?
I don't know. I can't change the past. I can't say what I was thinking at that moment when my mom called me and or would call me and ask me to come back home. I can't. I can only think about the future. I don't think I would have listened.
Yeah.
I was like standing my ground. No.
Yeah.
It's my thing.
But also, you, as I say, at a young age, you were financially independent, which very few people under the age of 20 are. You were financially independent, and
you don't know that as a kid.
Of course, you don't know.
But what
I mean is, it gives you that freedom to make those mistakes. Do you look back at that time and think, as you said before, it was a journey you had to go to get to the place that you are now? Do you think it was a price worth paying?
Yeah, I do. I think that moment when my lawyer didn't know I was going to plead guilty when I had this DUI situation.
So DUI.
It was the first moment
DUI,
that I had no, that I didn't have to talk to anyone.
Well, let me just explain DUI, because in England we call it drink driving. It's driving under the influence, isn't it? So you were done for driving under the influence the first time, and then you were done a couple of times.
I was 19. And then they kept it going for 10 years of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what America does. It was like the poster child for I don't know what.
Well, that was one
making a mistake.
That was one of the things that I found as well, which I found quite shocking, is that there was for eight years of your life, you were on probation for something.
So all that money, where'd that go to?
Yeah.
Lawyers.
So
I knew they wouldn't stop until they saw me behind bars. And I was like, maybe there's a reason. Maybe God is saying something that I just need to see the scariest thing that I've seen to just experience it, to then never do it again. And it worked.
When you're arrested and you're put in solitary confinement for 14 days, and as you said...
It was supposed to be 4 days.
And they were suggesting it was
because... Because it was a holiday that weekend, so those days didn't count.
Really?
America. Thank you, Trump! No, I remember being actually in jail, and the TV, they put the TV on, because they wouldn't put the clock, so you didn't know what time it was ever. They would change... They just took all the batteries out of the clocks, and Obama was sitting on The View in America and saying, yeah, I know Lindsay Lohan's in jail. And I literally screamed, well, then get me out.
So
it was the most, it was just the most surreal thing. I was like, my president's talking about me being in jail? What? Why? There are more important things in the world.
With all the problems of growing up and maturity, regardless of anybody, and if you know addicts, how difficult it is to be an addict and grow up, but to grow up during that journey in the public eye.
Yeah.
And I think that the stress that's got to put on somebody is very hard to try and relate to in normal life.
I think my problem was that I never paid attention to anyone saying anything, so I wasn't raised to think about it like that.
You weren't raised to think that what you do becomes public?
Yeah, not really.
Because
when I'm home, I'm home.
Yeah, but since the age of 12, what you've done has been public.
But my mother never kept magazines in the house. She never did any of that stuff with me around. I was just always working.
Yeah.
And I still am always working.
Yeah. And again, this is the, I suppose, the difficulty when you've become, I guess, a tabloid person.
But I think that was my problem then. I didn't have anyone really, I didn't listen to my mom. I didn't go home. I didn't want to pay attention to any of the stuff. So I just kept doing, it's like a cycle. You either stay in a sick cycle or you stay in a good one.
Yeah.
You know, and I just was angry that all the work that I'd done was overshadowed by any photo that was taken. It's like my mom said one thing to me once. She's like, if you've dated all these guys, you'd be dead. Like, it's impossible.
Yeah. You seem to be the focus for so many people from those early 20s, and it's carried on. And then you took that decision to come over to the UK and appear in a play. I think it was your first theatre experience in Speed the Plough.
That was the scariest thing I've ever done.
And again, there was a lot of things that I learned from you doing that. One is that, as you said, the bravery to do it. You know, you're 28 years of age, your career's at the rocky ride for a few years, and you go in the most public, most, I suppose, uncontrolled environment. Because in a film set, you can say, can I do it again?
Mm.
On stage.
Yeah, that's mammoth.
It's got to be right. And it's mammoth. It's not an easy
play. And I knew,
it's
and he wrote me once, he's like, I'm watching you.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
How did you find that whole experience?
I thought it was really amazing. The more I got more comfortable, when you think of the West End, you don't think of young kids going to see a show in the West End and flying in from other countries going to see a show in the West End and dressing nice for the West End. So it was really inspiring for me. I really saw a different kind of culture go to see shows and plays. And look, once I know something, I know it.
Yeah.
So it kind of bores me if I have to keep doing it. But with this play specifically, it was a way for me to finally challenge myself again to do something that was out of my comfort zone and then kind of play with it in the character. And I related to the character because she's a young girl. I mean, yeah. I've never actually experienced that, but it was an interesting...
It was a young girl and a producer's trying to better, basically, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that hasn't happened to me, but I was too young for that, thank God. But I understood it. I was like, oh, I've met producers like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's show people this. Let's really show people how it's really like. It was terrifying. I mean, it was really scary. But also learning how, you know, when you do the matinee, the different crowds that come in and how it works. But just knowing every second that the second you are there and show up or don't show up, those people have flown in to see that show for that amount of time, whereas a movie you can always see, you can download it. This is the only chance they get to see that. So it's a different diligence that I had within myself, and I really appreciated it, and I like it.
Yeah. Well, all the reviews seem to suggest that you were the best thing in it.
Thank you.
They do. I mean, I've read them. I've just made that up. And I again, it was something that I was surprised that the bravery of taking that, because I saw that.
No, I wanted to leave like the week before. I was like, I'm not, no.
Yeah, because there's no
I realised, I was like, oh my God, I'm so scared, I can't do it.
You know, for somebody like me, that's my job, I stand on stage, there is nowhere to hide. And surprisingly, now this is a bizarre coincidence, I saw a voice coach this morning. And I saw a voice coach because I'm going on tour. And so I'm going to do like 200 gigs. So I was there, Budgie, who was your voice coach, on Speed the Clap, Speed the Plow. Speed the Clown, yeah. I was thinking of jokes. Yeah. So she said she, for that period of time that you were in the play, she got a little glimpse into it, and she said it was just bonkers. She said there would be stories in the papers about you doing things, and she knows you didn't do them because she was with you. Mm. She said, you just make up lies. And she spoke to your manager and your boyfriend at the time and said, is this normal? And he said, that's it. That's a life that happens all the time.
Yeah. You know what it is also, I think, when you get to a certain point in your life, for anyone at any age, like I'm a Cancer, I'm a crab. I like to feel safe and be home. Safe is my most important word. You just realize it's like, what's left in going out that night or doing this that day, or just, it's okay to be okay. Mm. And I think it's really easy to lose sight of that when you're in the midst of things and going and going and going. Sometimes you have to just stop and just sit with it.
Yeah.
And think and appreciate. And I think, you know, when I was living in California, I was always looking for the next thing because nothing was ever feeding me enough. I didn't know what it was. And then I went to work with kids and that really helped. And that because that feeds me, my soul feels full then.
Yeah.
Selfishly, unselfishly, but I think it just, it takes that. Life is a journey. You just have to be willing to live it.
And that was one of the things that you seemed to say about when you came and did the play, you came to England.
I found peace when I got to England, when I got to London, when I moved to London. I felt a lot safer.
Just because the paparazzi weren't, the pressure wasn't the same in terms of that.
Yeah, and I started thinking about the business aspect of things and I really felt a good schedule. But also the press, the legal terms of it here is very different. Like if you live on a Mews Street, they can't come on the Mews Street and photograph you. Yeah. Whereas in America, it's free for all. And they have this mentality of the more, the better, which is not necessarily a good thing. And my first movie I did here, so I felt like I kind of regained my youth when I moved back here.
Yeah.
And then started thinking about the future.
What's your life like here? What do you do?
Because as I say, meetings and seeing friends and family and.
But what I mean is, you can move around London in a way you can't move around LA. You can walk around the streets.
I haven't been to LA in I don't know how long, and I'm so scared to go. It's just so overwhelming. Just landing at the airport, there is like, I get this like panic attack. Like I can't breathe.
Is that just because of the?
Just that moment of like, just it's just weird for me. I haven't had that in a long time.
Does that become normal, though? Does that ever... Was there ever a phase in your life where you just went, if the paps don't turn up, it's not worth me walking out the door?
No, Karl Lagerfeld told me, he goes, just imagine them as machine guns. Stand there quick and run.
Well, that's not...
That's what it felt like.
That must be why he wears sunglasses all the time. He looks absolutely terrified.
But it's true. It's once you don't have that, it starts to feel like that. It's like that sound is like that shudder. It's just... It's startling.
But this is the thing, like, you're often thought of for things outside of your job. And that's what I was trying to say before, when you look at the roster of people you work with and the successful films you've been in, acting is something, you know, you're basically bloody good at it.
Thank you.
You know, and doing more of it is the thing that, to me, seems the bit that's missing. I don't know whether you want to move away from it or just go back to it under your own terms.
Under my own terms.
And theatre is something you would consider?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I loved doing the play. I loved that.
And now...
And everyone becomes your family every day. It's, like, exciting. Every day is a new day, and I think it's great.
And the time that you've spent in Syria and we're in Turkey with the Syrian refugees, do you think that will be something you can ever walk away from? Is that a commitment that you've got to keep forever?
Oh, no, that's a commitment. And that family is a commitment to me, in Sultan Bailey, the Hussein family. I will go and see them religiously. And then there's some other projects that we're working on, and moving some of the people from the camps that are in Turkey, because there's such an overflow of it, back into a no-fly zone in Syria past the border. So that's the next discussion. So I've been actually welcomed into those discussions now, which is really, I feel really honored to be a part of.
So when you get, again, if you...
I'm going to start documenting it. So we're working on a documentary of it, which will start probably in March.
And you're doing that independent of any organisation like Save the Children or UNICEF?
I'm starting my own foundation, so I'm going to do it myself.
So for you as a person, if this transition in your life hadn't come where you nearly lost your finger, you stay, you get re-engaged with this, what do you think you would be doing?
I don't know. I can't answer that.
No, the reason I asked that is because it's completely different.
Look, I was in a very abusive relationship with my ex, and he was hitting me a lot, and I didn't know how to get out of it, and I did. And that was when things changed.
Yeah.
When I took control back in my life and said, no one's going to hurt me, I'm going to help other people, and I just need to focus on taking care of myself.
But when you say he was hitting you, like, violent, you know, physical abuse...
Yeah.
Again,
that's a hard thing. And I noticed, I looked back on it, I was like, oh my God, I saw my mom go through this, so I get it. I stayed because it was normal for me.
You know, I hesitated then because I guess really I didn't know how to ask you. But that was what I was going to ask, whether this was a repeat of your childhood.
Of course, subliminally, as a child, you recognize, I mean, in psychiatry, I studied psychiatry, you study that those moments become... It's almost like a safe chaos. So you just think it's normal, but it's not normal.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to myself that moment when he like ran out of my house, thank God, it was like, oh my God, I'm not going to put myself through what my mother went through. No, I got to go now. But this ends now.
Yeah. But as somebody who's been a victim of domestic violence, both as a family member and as an adult within a relationship, what message would you say to someone in that situation?
Well, my father never was physically abusive to my mother in front of me. I never saw that.
Oh, okay, so.
But before I was born, yeah, I've seen those photos.
But for you now, there'll be people watching this, no doubt, who are victims of domestic violence and kind of are locked in what you said, that almost that safe chaos. What would you say to somebody who came to you and said, look, this is what's happening to you?
I would just take them with me and be like, let's get you out of here. I don't know. I don't know, because it's really hard to talk to someone when they're in that situation, because you're scared, but you want to be strong, but you want to just make it calm. You don't really, I don't know how, I don't know. I just prayed for him to go, and he did. I just got by some angels, really. It was that bad. Yeah. And I didn't want anyone to know, so I just kept it, didn't talk about it.
No, well, I'll be honest.
Because for me, it's a whole different situation the second it's public.
Yeah. Oh, it is. And that's why I say sometimes the pressure on somebody with your level of celebrity is that, almost like what I've just done to you, then I've sort of said, well, you've been a victim of domestic abuse. Do you want to say something to someone else? And that's an unfair pressure. I've just felt
I just
that
don't know what I would say. I would just hug them.
Yeah. From your point of view, to be able to talk about it and be strong enough about it, and then...
It's important to talk about things that happen to you. It's important to express what you go through in life. How else do you release it?
Yeah, but again, you can talk about it if you're in a room with a therapist, but as you say, you talk about it and...
My life's public the way people want to make it anyway. Why not just be honest all the time?
Yeah, you say that, but again, when I was talking before about when you were going through the roughest part of your life, you said, I don't want to go on that, I want to go on this.
Because we were backtracking to a point that we'd already gone
on. I know, yeah, I was just trying to understand the chronology.
Fight?
No, we're not going to have a fight. Lindsay, you're half Irish.
You're getting super serious now.
You're half Irish, half telling you would twat me. I absolutely know. For somebody who's been through rehab, who's been through addictions, who's been through domestic violence, they're your problems, but they're public. And because of your celebrity, everyone knows about them. And everyone goes, great, we need a spokesperson on alcoholism, we'll go to Lindsay. We need a spokesperson on addiction, we'll go to Lindsay. If they want a reference
point. Forget about
point,
all the movies, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Becomes the discussion, not your career.
Well, let's not
your
use
skill.
This interview to make that continue to be the discussion.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to somehow say a sentence.
We're thinking
that
Little Mermaid, remember?
I'm trying to break
Walt Disney.
What I'm trying to
Dubai,
do.
Dubai, Disneyland, shiny lights, happy things, fireworks.
No, what I'm trying to do
Migos
is break
too.
It. I can't say me fucking sentence.
It's my show now.
No, that's what I'm trying to say is for you, so many things have happened that become public, so many things that people use as a way of understanding Lindsay Lohan, when in reality, the the bigger things are the career that you've done, the movies that have grossed over $500 million, and now this work that you're doing now, which again, you're at the top table in that. You're in discussions about, you know, refugee camps and moving people forward. That, to me, is the bigger story. And of all of your career path, the thing that really stood out to me, and I think it's probably because I understand how hard it is being a live performer, is that decision to do the play in England at that time.
Yeah.
You know, that came after the Lindsay series, that came after everything, and you're going, right, I'm going to now do something that really could hang me out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was, I think, super brave. It, again, speaking to the voice coach that I was working with, she was saying, like, you could tell people were coming in the hope you'd fail.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite things I've ever done.
How do you see the rest of your future? Because to me, you've lived a hell of a life, but you're only 30 years old.
I think I've just started everything I want to do by finally starting my own company, my own production company, own management company, starting my own charity. I think that everything started after my 30th birthday.
Yeah.
And I weirdly knew that for some reason. Look, I my mind doesn't stop working. And Scott, my manager, would attest to that. So his has to work half-time for me. But there's so many things that I want to do, and I'm actually doing them now.
Mm.
And it was other people controlling my life that kept me from doing it. Yeah. And now I actually just have no excuse, but everything falls on me. So yeah, it's my choice to do it, and it's mine.
Yeah, well, that, again, I was reading something the other day about the adult personality isn't shaped until you're at least 25. You know, by the time you were 25...
I was 30.
Yeah, that's what I mean. By the time you were 25, you'd already lived a life. The 5 years from you being 25 to 30 is an amazing career in itself.
Yeah.
And an amazing journey and life experience. The bit pre-25...
Whatever happened to saying, oh, sorry, I don't mean to ask your age?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, I'm 30.
You said it.
I say it, like, loud and proud. And people look at me like, what?
Oh, listen, Linz, don't start. I'm 50, right?
I know, you didn't start your comedic career until you were 40.
I know, no, listen, you missed it. I'll say it again. I'm 50.
He's 50.
No, oh, what? No. The bit is, I say I'm 50 and go, you're not 50.
Oh, my God, sorry. I was
Jesus, Lindsay.
No, you're not.
I'm fishing for a compliment.
Are you really?
So, Lindsay, I'm 50.
What?
Yeah, amazing. But what I'm saying is, you there are stages in your life where you reach and you go, all right, I need to take a step. And so me, as a man 50, I'm looking at that. I did a 40, I did a 30. But by the time I was 30, I could not have imagined that I'd lived the life that you lived, but also achieved what you've achieved. And the platform that you've got now moving forward, particularly, as you said, with this work that you're doing with the Syrian refugees, a work that has often been missed by everybody else.
I think it's just because people are scared, because perception, public perception, is it's scary to be in these places. And so they don't show the positive side of me going there and getting in and out, and it's fine. And we only see the bad.
Yeah.
We only see the bad things. We don't see any of the good work that gets done. So people are scared. It's no one's fault, but, you know, it's social media.
Yeah.
We live in a different world these days.
Absolutely. I think we all wish you well.
Thank you.
And I think we'd all agree that's been a wonderful conversation.
I hope you're not just saying that just to say
it. No, I mean, it was a conversation where at times I don't know which fucking way we were going. No. I got it back in the end. So, ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Lindsay Lohan.
Thank you.
Thank you.